Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Shank of katelovingshank.com, prayerprescriptions.com, and the author of the upcoming book, Prayer Prescriptions, Spiritual Remedies for Long-Lasting Health. My guest today is Gary Kowalski, author of Goodbye Friend, about the passing of our dear animal friends and the grief of those situations. And he is also the author of the upcoming book, Blessings of Animals. Gary decided to write Goodbye Friend in preparation for the death of his beloved dog, Chinook, who was 11 when he began writing the book. The call-in number is 347-205-9200, and joining me now is Gary Kowalski. Hello, Gary.
Hi, Kate. Good to be with you. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. I am happy that you're here. This is a near and dear topic of mine, believe it or not.
Well, it touches all of us who have animals in our lives. You know, sooner or later, you're going to reach that point where you have to end the relationship. It's one of the tragedies of this bond we share with animals, that dogs and cats and most other domestic animals have such short lifespans. So grief is built into the equation. From the day we let these animals into our lives, we know that we're going to have to say farewell.
Yeah. On the other hand, I have, as you do point out in your book, there are some very esoteric kind of metaphysical types of bonds and communications that people have when their pets go on. And you cannot deny that. So, I mean, so you have to wonder whether we really are realistic to think that we're saying goodbye when in reality they are always with us, and not just with us in our hearts, but always with us somehow in spirit, and somehow they're always with us. You know, that's been my experience with these beautiful animals.
Well, that's true, Kate. And I think that people's beliefs about what happens when we die, whether we'll meet our loved ones, including our pets again, this can be a source of consolation to us. And there are all, as you say, there are these mysterious, curious stories of visitations and continuing connections that people have with their pets, but I think the pain of parting is very real nonetheless, and
absolutely
has to be addressed.
Absolutely. It's, even though I know that they are with me forever, I have to say that the parting of these animals kind of just is the worst kind of pain that there is. I mean, I love my human family, and that would be all of them and all of us, but there's something so much more
I think we have a very pure bond with our animals. The relationship that we share with them is very pure and uncluttered. There's no manipulation in the relationship. There are no hidden messages. It's just a bond of mutual love and affection and, you know, in some cases, adoration. So when that bond is severed, I think the grief, the pain can be especially intense. And as you say, it is as difficult as the ending of any relationship. I tell the story of my good friend Iris, who has always had animals in her life. She's been the leader of our statewide effort to ban leg hold traps, which is a cause she took up when one of her dogs was caught in one of those devices. But she told me about her horse, Sentimental Journey. That was the name of a song that was popular when she was a young girl. She got the horse when she was 16 years old, you know, just coming of age. And horses live for a long time, 35, 40 years sometimes. So she was in midlife in her 40s when the horse passed. And she said not to take away at all from the loss of her parents, but there was something about that bond she shared with the horse that was even more traumatizing, because with an animal, it's daily. You're feeding the animal. She was grooming the horse, exercising it each day. If you have a dog, it's morning and evening. With the cat, they're there when you wake up and when you go to bed, and they may sleep with you. That's a pretty intimate relationship. So it's very tactile. It's very hands on, and when that goes missing, it leaves an awfully big hole.
Absolutely, it is true that in the case of my husband and I, we spend all of our time with the dogs we've had for the last 15 years, and in the sense that we've arranged it so that they're not here by themselves. You know, sometimes dogs have long periods of time when they are by themselves. So if he goes to work, I'm here, or when I go to work, he is here, and that has we're always with these animals, and as you say, that creates quite an intimate bond. That and it's less complicated, and it is more pure, as you say.
Yes, but I think all, many, we're not the only species that grieves either, you know. The experience of loss is common to many animals. In fact, one of the first experiences that opened my eyes to the bond we share with other animals was when I heard about Coco, the gorilla, and her kitten. This was about 20 years ago. It's a well-known story. It's been written up in National Geographic and so forth. But Coco had asked for a kitten for her birthday. Coco was a gorilla, a female lowland gorilla, involved in one of these primate language projects, which is how she was able to ask for a kitten. Puss in Boots was one of her favorite picture books, and so she asked for this kitten, and they quickly became good friends. And then one night, the cat escaped from the compound at the Gorilla Foundation out in Woodside, California, where the two of them lived, and was hit by a car. According to the accounts, when Coco was told about this, she just was in shock. At first it was though she did not believe it or comprehend. There was no affect, but then quickly after a few minutes she was very visibly upset. And what struck me about that was, supposedly one of the trainers, one of the people who worked with Coco, was able to ask her some questions to see how much she understood about this loss, and Coco was asked, why do gorillas die? And Coco made the signs for trouble and old. And then the gorilla was asked, where do gorillas go when they die? And Coco made the signs for comfortable, hole, like a hole in the ground. I don't know where she got that. That's interesting, isn't it? And then made the sign of goodbye, touching her fingers to her lips and blowing a kiss of farewell. And finally, Coco was asked, how do gorillas feel when they die? Are they happy, sad, afraid? And Coco made the sign for sleep. So this was an animal that was obviously not just experiencing emotions around this loss, but reflecting on what it meant. And it really opened my mind, because just about the time that I heard that, I'd lost my own grandfather, who was the primary male figure in my life. And it started me thinking, and it really opened my heart too to animals in a new way, to understand that we share this spiritual dimension with them of love and affection and hope and mutual care. So the grief process is part of our biological inheritance, but that was also a very healing story for me too, to realize that, well, I'd lost my grandfather, but I realized that just like Coco, I would find a way to get through this. And in that way, animals can be our teachers and healers.
Yeah, there's something, how they get you outside, especially a dog or a horse, animals, other animals maybe not so much, but they get you outside in nature. And there's such a beautiful, just a real spiritual connection that you can develop, and that actually we have with the outdoors and the animals.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, I know.
Well,
nature's
nature's a great healer. You know, there's all this research. If they put patients in a hospital room and one of them has a window that looks out on a parking lot and another one looks out on trees and birds and the natural environment, and the ones who have a view onto nature require fewer painkillers, they have a faster recovery after surgery and so forth.
Yes.
But this has been known for thousands of years. You know, one of the chapters in my book, Goodbye Friend, is about the book of Job, which is very old, at least like 2,500 years old. And Job is a figure who has experienced a lot of loss. You know, he's lost his family, he's lost his health, he's lost his reputation. Everything that he owned or cared about has been taken away from him. And he's asking, why has this happened? Why do bad things happen? And the climax of that book in the Hebrew Bible comes when God appears to Job, and God opens Job's eyes by taking him on a great tour of the natural world. First, you know, just the awesome scale of the creation. You know, God says, you know, look at the stars, the heavens. Do you know who set the bounds to the sea, or have you explored its depths? But then most of the poetry comes in the form of Job's encounter with the animal world. And God says to Job, you know, look at the eagle that feeds her young, or the antelope that goes into the mountains to give birth. How do they know when the time has come? Or the ostrich who lays her eggs and trusts the warm soil to bring the chicks to birth? And all of these kind of nurturing, feminine, mothering images. And then there are all these images of that I characterize as being more masculine, kind of. It's like, and look at this. Think about the hippopotamus or the crocodile. Can you hook the hippo to your plow, or the wild stallion. And Job somehow is transformed through this encounter with the animal kingdom, which is, mm-hmm. is striking in a way, because you know that there's a this is a true story. Mm-hmm. Jane Goodall in her autobiography talks about losing her second husband Derek Bryson to cancer. Mm-hmm. And it was a especially virulent disease. It wasn't treatable with the usual intervention. She tried everything, and it was also very painful. It wasn't the painkillers weren't working, and she really watched her husband die slowly and in agony. It was not a good death. And mm-hmm. she says in her autobiography that she was just hollowed out, devastated for about 2 years after that. And the healing moment occurred when she went back to Africa. She'd been lecturing, as she often does. And she went back to Africa to be with the chimpanzees. And she arrived there at the Gombe Stream Reserve. And a storm had just passed. She talks about climbing up into the hills and having this kind of mystical moment when she says time stopped and space expanded, and she said it was like a heightened awareness. She was noticing all the raindrops on every single leaf, all the scents and aromas of the vegetation and the leaves and her own body and the smell of the chimpanzees. And then she looked off in the distance, she said, and saw an antelope, a bush buck, standing in the sun. And she said that was the moment she felt the peace passing understanding. Those were her words. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really a parallel to the kind of thing Job is describing. So
right.
Those are extremely powerful instances of animals healing us, calming our spirits, bringing us into a new dimension of awareness. But in more everyday ways, too, I think animals can do that. So
well, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So I certainly think that spending time in nature is always good advice, and particularly if you've suffered some kind of loss in your life, like mm-hmm. Saying goodbye to a pet.
I was going to ask you. You said that you wrote Goodbye Friend as a way to soften the blow when you knew that Chinook, who was your dog, who was 11 at the time, was going to die. And I was wondering, did that writing the book help you with that?
Oh, yes and no. Yes and no. You know, you never get used to death. At least I don't. I mean, I'm a minister. I'm a religious
right.
professional. I've worked with probably hundreds of families over the course of my career who are trying to plan funerals or memorial services, and
mm-hmm.
who are coping with the loss of loved ones. It never gets any easier when I get that call and learn that there's been a death. There's always something raw about it. So I did start writing this book when my dog was 11, and at that point you see the writing on the wall. You know, the vet had told me that Chinook didn't have more than a couple more years anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I was kind of gathering up everything I knew or had learned, and writing the book for myself as much as for other readers to help them through this life transition.
Yeah.
Did it, well, I hope it's helped others. You know, I think one thing that helps Kate, is just to have the loss acknowledged, because we still live in a society and a culture where many people will say, oh, it's just a dog, just a cat, get another pet, get over it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a grief denying and a death denying culture, and people, you know, you may get a little bit of sympathy or understanding for a day or two, or even a week or two, but after a week or two, it's really just starting to hit you. So,
I know. Yeah.
So, you know, for several years, I did animal blessing services at my church, often on the feast of St. Francis, and people would bring in their dogs and cats and guinea pigs and parrots and other pets. But every year I would have a moment in that service when people could come forward to remember their departed critters and light a candle. The first time that I did such a service, I had about a dozen candles ready and 50 people came up. And the next year I had 50 candles. I thought I was prepared, and, you know, 100 people came up.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's a really an ocean of unspoken, unacknowledged, unvalidated grief out there. And it's meaningful to people just to have someone make the statement that, yes, this is a serious loss. And to have that done in a religious setting, too, is meaningful for many people.
It is. And you have so many wonderful stories of healing that our animals bring us, and that beautiful story of the young boy in a coma who probably would have died if it weren't for the fact that the medical personnel allowed the dog in to see him, and it's just a miraculous revival of him.
Right.
That's,
well,
that's so cool.
I have another story very similar. We had the therapy dogs of Vermont come into my church in Burlington one year, and the head of the therapy dogs is a guy named Steve Ryman, and we have kind of a regional medical center. He told about one instance where a girl had been helicoptered in, I think on a Friday night, an aneurysm had ruptured in her brain, and she was unconscious and unresponsive. They couldn't bring her back to life. And she'd been in this condition for about 5 days. The doctors had tried everything. You know, young girl, like 14 years old.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I know. Steve came in with his therapy dogs, and the mother was in the room, and the mother said she was going to go out for a cup of coffee or something. Steve said by the time the mother came back, the girl was sitting up in a chair. She was wide awake and smiling. And what had happened was the dogs, one of them had actually crawled up into bed with this girl and sprawled out across her chest. And, you know, something about that warm, tickling fur and that dog that maybe even applied a little miracle dog slobber to her face, you know, that did the trick that modern medicine could not do. So it was puppy love that really restored her to life. And it's who knows? The world is full of inexplicable incidents like that.
Yeah, I mean, using animals to heal is really, even though we do have therapy dogs and we have a lot of that going on, it's not used enough because institutions won't let them in. Certainly, they're allowed in nursing homes, but they're not allowed in hospitals. And this is where they would be needed in certain acutely, you know, serious situations like that. And that is a beautiful... I wonder if this girl had a dog of her own, or if her mother thought that maybe she should have one after that, or what the story is.
Well, I don't know. I would think it would change your mind about dogs. If you didn't like them before, you'd probably love them afterwards. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And I the story of Kubler-Ross, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Yes.
It reminded me that there's a lot of trauma surrounding the love that people have for their animals. And most of that trauma has to do surrounds that, because we're surrounded by people who don't love animals and don't have any regard for them.
Right, right. Just to bring your listeners up to speed, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, of course, is the great pioneer in the study of death and dying. And she recounts an episode from her own childhood. As a child, she was one of three girls, a set of triplets. And even her parents had a hard time telling her apart from her two sisters. They were identical, but she had pet rabbits. And these rabbits, whether through smell or some other kind of unseen sense, were one of the only ones who could tell Elizabeth apart from her two sisters. But her father didn't look on these rabbits as pets at all. He looked on them as food for the dinner table. And one by one, he sent Elizabeth down to the butcher shop to have these bunnies killed and prepared for the family table. And finally, it came down to her favorite named Blackie, and she tried to get the little bunny to run away, but it was too attached to her. And she was so scarred, so traumatized by that incident, that she completely repressed it. She forgot about it. She pushed it down below her conscious awareness only decades later as an adult, after having helped hundreds of people through this process of end-of-life awareness. Was she able to recover that memory? So, yes. And you know, that story speaks of the powerful bond that children have with animals, which is very strong. You know, it's interesting, Kate. Dream researchers have found that very young children dream about animals all the time. Preschoolers, it's like 50% of their dreams have animals in them, and often wild animals, not necessarily critters that they see around the house, but bears and gorillas and so forth. By the time we get to be adults, it's comparatively rare for animals to be in our dreams, but it just seems like our psyche has this natural menagerie that lives inside our brains. And the Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson, he suggests that the human species has an innate sense of what he calls biophilia, the love of life. Kids are just naturally drawn towards living creatures. It's spontaneous, and you know, there's an innocence and directness that children and animals share. So for kids and pets, that bond is very strong also, and parents need to take special care when they're trying to help a child who's struggling with the loss of an animal, because for most kids, the loss of a pet is going to be one of the most significant, momentous events in their young lives. College students will typically identify the loss of a family pet as, you know, the the biggest thing they've had to cope with up to that point in their early young adulthood. So it requires some special care.
Oh, yes, it does. And I was thinking that there's probably a lot of stories about trauma that, like post-traumatic stress is what I gather from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's experience. And, it's kind of traumatic when the animal dies, but what happened to her was, on the par of great trauma. And also I've read in other places that she had a very difficult relationship with her father. And I would think so. Yeah, and maybe it was just because of that, but he was kind of a tyrannic kind of taskmaster. So, yeah, that's a tough one. That's for sure a tough one.
Right.
I was wondering if you would tell us about some of the ceremonies that you have done for the animals that come to your congregation. You know, some of the touching moments that you've had.
Well, people often in my congregation have come to me when they've lost their animals. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book was to help people with that situation. A couple of years ago, I had an occasion to help a family in my church that was in the process of saying goodbye to their beloved dog, Ben, who had been a frequent playmate with my own dog, Chinook, but Ben was a couple of years older. And it was a case where they called the vet to come to the home to administer euthanasia.
Mm-hmm.
Another member of my congregation who is musical came and played the guitar, just some quiet tunes. I brought some poems and some prayers. The whole family was gathered around. So, I mentioned that in my book as an example of an exit that was well thought through and carefully considered. Many of us will have to come to that point of considering euthanasia for our pets. Many people don't want to think about it, but often there comes a point when it is the humane and compassionate choice. It's very hard to know exactly when the right moment is, but
right.
at some point for the pet, they've lost their quality of life, and at that point in. As in the case of this family saying goodbye to old Ben, I think it's a kindness and an act of mercy to help usher them out of the world, surrounded by love, surrounded by beauty, surrounded by the assurance that they're cared for, that there's nothing to fear.
Mm-hmm.
So. It's a privilege to be a part of those kinds of occasions and to be with people through those passages.
Yes. Gary, just what I'm thinking about it, how can our listeners reach you? Do you have a website, and could you tell us what that is?
Yeah, I have a website. It's kowalskibooks.com. My name's Kowalski, so kowalskibooks.com.
Mm-hmm.
But Goodbye Friend is available on Amazon or through Barnes & Noble or independent booksellers.
Mm-hmm.
It's fairly easy to get a hold of. And if people want to contact me on my website, kowalskibooks.com, there's a contact form. So if people would like to communicate personally, I'm certainly open to that.
Wonderful. Getting back to euthanasia, the last two dogs that I had, they actually died in my arms. The first one had a tumor on his snout that, the last week, he was having problems breathing, but we would often lie with him and meditate with him, and, you know, and then he would be relieved. But then he just died suddenly, and I was able to catch him in my arms. And that was a good death. There's a chapter in your book called A Good Death. That was a good death because he was with me, and although I think what you're describing in terms of having a beautiful service with euthanasia is really beautiful. And then my second dog just died in January, and I shouldn't say my second dog. I've had many, many dogs over the years.
Yes, yes.
But I had a traumatic experience happen about 30 years ago where it took me 28 years to get a dog. So, speaking of traumatic situations, but this dog died in our arms as well. And he didn't want to leave us, you could tell. And it was so heartbreaking, but I would much rather it happen that way. And then there's all these other kinds of stories that you describe also where animals know when it's time for them to die and they'll just walk off and go into the woods.
Well, yes. Back to Kubler-Ross, she says that the final stage of the dying process is what she calls withdrawal. You see this with human patients. I mean, it's the conventional wisdom of ICUs that people die at 2 or 3 in the morning after all the family and visitors have gone home.
Right.
There comes a point when, Kubler-Ross says, when people have said their goodbyes to the world and they go into themselves to do their inner work, to make their final transactions with their unfinished hopes or regrets, and to meet God or to connect with the mystery, and that's very private, and animals do that. The Connie Howard, the director of our local Humane Society, talked about how her cat, in the middle of a Vermont winter, went into hiding under the porch. This was not a place the cat would ordinarily seek out Vermont winter, but the cat was experiencing kidney failure, and it was doing its best to find an appropriate place to leave the world. So I think animals sometimes do know or have an instinct when it's time for them to leave.
Yes, they do. And our cats, three of our cats just crawled off and died that way.
Yeah.
I think the dog who had the tumor in his snout wanted to just crawl off too, but I wouldn't let him.
Yeah.
Oh, I should have, but I couldn't do that.
We started this conversation, Kate, by mentioning inexplicable and paranormal incidences, and the sense that a spirit persists beyond death. There are these kinds of incidents, and I relate one of them in my book. A woman shared how her husband died experiencing heart failure, and he was having a heart attack, and she called the ambulance, and the emergency medical technicians came in to begin trying to resuscitate him. He was in the bedroom, and she was in the kitchen. And
mm-hmm.
they had two dogs at that time, and the dogs were out on the patio. She could see them through the sliding glass door in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But despite that, the EMTs two or three times yelled out from the bedroom, "Get this dog out of here!" And she yelled back, "They're what dog? The dogs are here. There's no dogs." And they repeated it, "Get the dog out of here!"
Oh, gosh.
And she was very puzzled and couldn't figure out what was going on. And finally, she made the connection that, well, her husband had had a very special animal in his life. Many of us do, you know. There's that
mm-hmm.
that one
mm-hmm.
lifetime dog who you're it's just kind of your soulmate, right?
Mm-hmm.
For him, that was Ginger, who had passed on several years previously, but she decided that the dog that the medics were talking about, that must have been Ginger in the bedroom, because there was no real dog there. Now, you know, she could see the dogs out on the patio. Must have been Ginger waiting there to accompany her husband over to the other side.
So he did die.
Well, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But there's a long history of dogs serving as spirit guides to take us through this transition.
Yes, tell us more about that. That's fascinating.
Well, it's very old and it's curious, but you find images and traditions of dogs being spirit guides in cultures from Egypt to China to Mesoamerica and Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You find ceramic dogs buried in the tombs of Central America. You find some of the earliest human burials that we know of, some of the earliest excavations in the Middle East and Northern Europe contain sites where a person has been buried together with a dog. So this seems to go way, way back. And, you know, why would people make that connection? Well, one reason might be that, you know, as long as people have lived with dogs, they've known that canines have this mysterious homing sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're far from home, oftentimes they're back. So they do have this homing sense, and maybe that's the connection. It's possible. The idea that the dog is a spirit guide has also been connected with legends surrounding the dog star Sirius.
Oh, yes.
Most of your listeners probably know Sirius. It's the brightest star in the sky. It's very easy to find. And if you can find Orion, the three stars on the belt point right down to Sirius. Orion's mm-hmm. the hunter, and Sirius is his dog, always at the hunter's heels. But the Egyptians thought Sirius was the abode of souls. The Navajo called Sirius the wolf dog.
Mm-hmm.
For the Cherokee, Sirius was a spirit guide. And in India, there's this wonderful story that's told in the Mahabharata, one of the very old scriptural traditions.
Mm-hmm.
The hero of the tale is on his way to paradise, and he's scaling the Himalayas up to the abode of the gods, and all his fellow pilgrims fall by the wayside. But the hero attains the summit, and there he meets the king of the gods, Indra. And Indra mm-hmm. says, "Welcome, well done. You've made it to the top, but you're ready now to enter into eternity, but you have to leave your dog behind." Mm-hmm. And the hero says, "But this dog's been with me through thick and thin. I can't abandon the dog." And Indra, the king of the gods, says, "Well, there's no place in heaven for mutts." And at that point, the hero says, "Well, you know what? If you won't take dogs in heaven, I'm not going either." So, yes, it's a wonderful story. And at that point, this had just been another test. And the dog, whose name is Savannah, at that point morphs into a deity. And Savannah, the dog, takes his place in the heavens and becomes the dog star, Sirius. Mm-hmm. And the hero also, you know, goes on into the higher realms of bliss. So it's a wonderful story about we hope whatever heaven there is, dogs are allowed. But I think, you know, I think the meaning of the myth is also that whatever we think about the bliss that awaits us, there's also the bliss that's here and now of love and affection and loyalty and commitment. That mm-hmm. you know, that's kind of a foretaste of heaven, the relationship that we have with these animals right now.
Yeah, first of all, Savannah is a wonderful name for a dog. If anybody's looking, I never heard the name, and it certainly would have very heroic implications to name your dog Savannah.
And that would be a good name for a dog, wouldn't it?
It's a good name, and I will keep that one in mind.
apparently in Sanskrit, it means dog. So very appropriate, but it's the dog star. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, and then another thing that reminds me of this is that we took our dog. Now, just Chinook is on the cover of your book. Is that right?
No, that's not Chinook. That's a generic dog, but it looks a little like Chinook. He was a rescue dog, so we don't know his precise pedigree. He didn't really have one, but he was a beautiful animal. Looked a little like a hybrid of a yellow lab and a husky or malamute. Had that mm-hmm. beautiful blonde color, but the strength and build of a husky with the pointed ears and the curled tail and the heavy coat.
Beautiful.
He fared well in Vermont. He loved the winters there.
I bet he did. Well, I was going to say now, our dog Ulysses, who just died in January.
Ulysses.
Yes.
That's a great name, too.
I don't like naming dogs stupid names. So anyway, this dog Ulysses had a bout with cancer. So we took him to a place nearby called the Grotto of Lourdes, which is a very healing place. It has beautiful statues of St. Francis.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know that I was raised a Unitarian, so I just like all the world religions. So it wasn't, but I was drawn to this place because it is a high power place in the universe. And there's something so powerful about statues of Mary. Mother Mary is very big there. So I took Ulysses there for a healing, and the director of the place came out, and he just almost cried when he saw Ulysses because he had a golden retriever who died on the operating table, and he was never mm-hmm. able to get it. He was so moved. It was such a horrible thing for him. And he said that after the death of that dog, he was with some – he is a devout Roman Catholic. So he was with some priests at a dinner, and the priest told him that dogs don't go to heaven. And he
right.
rose up and he actually defied authority. And he said, just like it said in the Mahārāba that if the dog don't go to heaven, then he doesn't want to go there either. And it really sort of shocked the priest. But I was really proud of him for,
to
stand up like that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, I do mention this in my book, Goodbye Friend. There are differing teachings, and within the Jewish and Christian tradition, there are differing teachings. If you go back to very early Christianity in the catacombs of the first through the third century, there are all these images of Jesus surrounded by the animals. You know, he's carrying a lamb, and he's got a dove on his shoulder, and there are wolves and turtles and dolphins and just all the creatures of the world around him. And obviously, these are images of paradise. You know, paradise past and to come. So for the early Christians, clearly Jesus was the Lord and Savior of the animals. Also, that changed through the centuries, but it's always been one of the options for Christian believers. In other faith traditions, you know, there are differing beliefs. The only book in the Hebrew Bible that really addresses the question directly is Ecclesiastes. Who's kind of maybe the most worldly wise and skeptical of the writers of the Bible, and Ecclesiastes basically says, "Who knows? You know, who knows? Does the spirit of the human go up and the spirit of the animal go down to earth?" It's one of the great unknowns. But again, for the very early Jewish traditions, if you go back to the book of Genesis, in the second chapter, it says again in the myth of the garden, Adam was created, and God saw that Adam was lonely, and so God created the animals to be companions. And God endowed Adam with nefesh chayim. That's the Hebrew term for a living soul. And it says God also gave the animals nefesh chayim, living souls. So there wasn't any real distinction between the soul of the animal and the soul of the man, at least not for the very early thinkers in this tradition.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but yes, it's I'm kind of an agnostic on it. I don't know what happens when we die. There's a quote from the 19th century preacher Henry Ward Beecher, as he was on his deathbed and approaching that threshold, his final words were, "And now." The mystery. And I thought that was great.
Yeah.
You know, going to it with a feeling of wonder, of curiosity, without fear, with hopefulness. So that's the way I'd like to go. And I think it's what I hope people can feel in regard to their beloved animals. Our beliefs about what happens will perhaps inevitably differ. You know, they'll inevitably differ. Even Paul in the New Testament said, "Right now we're looking through a glass darkly; we can't see it clearly."
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we have anything to fear. We're in good hands.
Yes, you have some beautiful, I'd say poetry, prayers at the end of your book that I have. That one prayer of St. Francis is something that isn't generally, I have not even seen it before. And, you know, we all know that the prayer of St. Francis, "Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace," but this one is something I had not heard of
before.
Oh, well,
the canticle of brother son.
Yes.
It's fairly well known, the song to brother sun and sister moon, but Francis gives thanks for the rushing water and for the lights of heaven and for the animals and also for brother death. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful hymn.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the background of that is that at the time he wrote it, Francis was near death. He was going blind at the
mm-hmm.
time he wrote this hymn of you know, open your eyes to the beauty of creation. And as you can imagine, the treatments for blindness in the 13th century were not very effective. In fact, they
mm-hmm.
were terribly painful. So he was
mm-hmm.
he was in considerable distress and couldn't even see the world when he wrote this magnificent hymn of praise and gratitude for the beauty of it all. Really a testament to the spirit. But yeah, I included the poetry in the back of the book because poetry's been one of the things that helps me through times of grief. It just seems to come out of the depths and
mm-hmm.
speak to the depths. It doesn't come out of that little rational worrying brain. It comes out of the same part of the brain that creates great songs and music and hymns of jubilation. So poetry's helped me. You know, I can probably recite one from memory. There's Wendell Berry's "The Peace of Wild Things," and this, you know,
mm-hmm.
this speaks again to the healing qualities of nature and the ability of animals to take us into a place of consolation. The poem goes, "When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the presence of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world and am free." I'm not sure I got that totally right, but I don't know. There's a beauty in the language that somehow the hopefulness and the peace comes through the language. It sings through the language. So I hope that the poems in the book will be soothing to,
yeah.
to people. And,
I was totally delighted with that. I love that.
Yeah, poems.
You
just need to sit with them. You just need to spend time with them, and that's similar to this book too. You know, a lot of people ask me the question, Kate, well, what should you do to help yourself get through this? You know, can you give us a to-do list of how to cope with loss? And I certainly have concrete suggestions for things you can do, like creating a memorial service and writing a eulogy and things like that. But, you know, when you lose a beloved friend, there's not a to-do list. There's not a checklist of things you can walk through and then you're done with this. You know, death
No.
isn't that kind of reality. It's
mm-hmm.
not a problem that you can resolve and then put behind you. It's
mm-hmm.
It's a part of life, and it's a great mystery. You have to wrestle with it. You have to struggle with it. You have to to sit with it. You have to somehow let your being come to a place of understanding and acceptance, and finally, I think you can break through to a point of peace. But it's like a poem. It never ends. You keep going back to it.
Right. It's a process, and sitting with it for as long as it takes is the only recommendation I would have.
Yes, and as long as it takes, maybe longer than you think. You know, I said earlier that many people minimize the loss. When I was researching this book, a lot of the clinical literature from psychologists would say, oh, gee, if people are grieving more than a month or two, it's pathological. Well, that's silly, you know.
That's rubbish, yeah.
It's often a year or two before really the pieces start to come back together, and
mm-hmm.
you really feel like you're completely re-engaged, and it's not like you get over it. You know, the relationship never ends. It's always been a part of your life, and it will always
mm-hmm.
be with you. But you're not
mm-hmm.
in acute distress anymore.
Yeah.
It becomes woven into the tapestry of your being. It's just one more thread.
Right. Gary, we've come to the end of the hour, and I want to mention again KowalskiBooks.com, and also go to Amazon and just, you know, search for Goodbye Trend. I certainly have enjoyed this hour, and I love animals more than sometimes people. But I also, but I do love people too, because I'm a nurse and I've been one for almost 30 years. So what the heck, you gotta love it all.
It's been wonderful talking with you, Kate, and thanks
I've
for having me
it.
On the show.
Thank you so much. I'm gonna be playing some music and.
And I've got this new book, Blessings of the Animals, coming out. So let's talk again, okay?
Oh my gosh, that would be so cool. I would love that, and I would
okay.
look forward to having that be published.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
Music for Mother and Child by Klaus D. Jensen. Here we go.